Welcome. This is an audio recording of the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. I'm Jim Falk, President of the Council. The Council is a nonprofit membership organization dedicated to engaging the public in an exploration of global issues and foreign affairs, and we produce over 80 public events each year. To learn more about us or to become a member, visit dfwworld.org. This podcast is made possible through the generous support of Haynes & Boone, LLP. We hope you enjoy it.
The Saturday of Melrose has focused on timely topics that lead and encourage vibrant discussion. We've looked at the Patriot Act, we've talked about the prospect of democracy in the Middle East, and certainly today's topic is no different. In fact, just a few days ago, the New York Times had this article, and it discussed the line between civilian and soldier. And that was written because on Monday, a federal appeals court rejected the new intermediate category proposed by the Bush administration in 2001, termed unlawful enemy combatant, a term intended for people affiliated with the Taliban or Al-Qaeda. In fact, Senator Dave O'Connor, among other very senior jurists, made such comments as that this is a hybrid warrior. We're fighting in a hybrid war. So we're extremely lucky today to have someone who has really devoted his career to analyzing and commenting on such legal definitions. General Michael Marchand will be speaking on detainee operations and the rule of law. He served in the United States military for over 32 years as Army Judge Advocate, General Corps, as Assistant Judge Advocate General in the Army, Commander of the Legal Services Agency, and Chief Appellate Judge of the U.S. Army. He's testified frequently before Congress and briefed the Defense Committee on such critical issues as the abuses that occurred at Abu Ghraib. General Marchand received his Bachelor of Arts degree from St. John's University and his JD degree from the University of Minnesota. He was one of two-star generals in the Corps. In recognition of his many accomplishments, he's received such awards as the Army Distinguished Service Medal and the Legion of Merit. Since June 2005, General Marchand has been president of the Center for American and International Law, and this really is one of our community's most highly regarded educational institutions. The center was founded in 1947 to provide training to lawyers and law enforcement officials, not just from the United States, but now from over 130 countries. Through its seven institutes, including the Institute for International and Comparative Law, high-ranking lawyers come to Plano, just about 20 minutes up the road from here, to enroll in some of the center's renowned continuing education courses. And I'm very pleased that the World Affairs Council will be continuing to collaborate with this outstanding center in Plano. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome General Mike Marchand.
I know, I was beginning to get very comfortable with Jim's talk, maybe we should just go on. I could find that certainly very equally pleasant. It is my pleasure to be here, and thanks for the invitation to speak. It's a topic that I thought when Jim first talked to me about it, detainee abuse and detainee operations, that was simply too stale. That it was something that was certainly part of my life. For the last couple of years, I was in the Pentagon. I spent many hours talking to the Senate Armed Services Committee and the House Armed Services Committee and various staffers and members about what happened or what didn't happen or what we would do and what we should do and what might be done to correct some of the abuses over time with prisoner operations. Little did I know that this week there would be five or six editorials on detainee operations. Certainly the nature of what we were talking about changed from when I was on active duty and working particularly with the Bagram cases and Abu Ghraib cases and in the wake of some of our soldier misconduct. And I'll try to touch on that a bit. But what I'd really like to try to do today is to try to put this whole idea of detainee operations in some kind of context. I think it's something that I've not really seen in the press. Mostly what I read in the press or see on TV has to do with one side or the other talking about either the rule of law in the sense of why isn't this in federal court, or another side saying there are no rules and there shouldn't be any rules and Geneva Conventions can't apply and what's the sense of all this? How are we going to do that? And I think the first thing that you've got to try to conceptualize, either agree or disagree with at least, that we're talking about a war on terror. I think if you accept the fact that there is a war, then everything fits in a better context. If you cannot accept a war on terror, then there's not much sense in talking about things like Geneva Conventions. Because if it's not really a conflict, then those rules don't apply. That's what they're designed to do. So from my perspective, if you start by saying there is a war on terror, and the purpose of some of our rules are to impact the conduct of belligerents when they are at war, then I think we can put this sort of in a context that makes a little bit more sense. And I picked as a title detaining operations in the rule of law intentionally for that reason, to try to put some context in there. It's sort of amazing to me to be a retired, well, not amazing to be retired from the Army, it happens to everybody, but within our structure, Mother Army, it's wonderful that all the various branches will usually commission a portrait or some sort of picture by Don Siders. And the idea is to pick a topic and a theme that sort of stands for what your branch really is supposed to stand for. And of course, the Judge Advocate General's Corps, being made up of lawyers and lawyer supporters, we wanted to find a legal topic. And what we picked and had Don Siders paint was a portrait of the first Judge Advocate General of the Army, John Lawrence, Colonel John Lawrence, Washington's lawyer, as he is prosecuting Major John Andre, a British spy. And I find it somewhat ironic that I get to be in front of you today is to say, so many years ago when we commissioned this portrait, we picked as a topic to define us a soldier prosecuting a spy in what might be called the military commission, the first military commission. So it's not something new. It's not something that we haven't had to contemplate before. Certainly it happened in the Mexican Wars. It happened in World War II, after World War II. So throughout history, we've certainly done that. I suppose the first distinction one talks about, if you're really talking about war and military commissions and detainee operations, is why not just criminal action? Certainly recent litigation. The Fourth Circuit has just found, for example, that in fact, people who are lawfully in the United States, whether they're citizens or not, must be put through the criminal justice system. And that would be a way of trying to do that. Hopefully I'll get to a point where I can say why that won't work in many cases or why that would be an undue burden on our soldiers. But certainly for those people residing in the United States, Elmira being just the last case, or we'll talk a little bit perhaps about Hamdi and Hamdan. Now, I guess before I scare all of you, I'm not going to try to make this such a lawyer's talk that you have to have your Black's Law Dictionary or whatever to try to go along. I'm trying to make this more of one of policy, more of consideration than one of law. But there will be a couple of times, I think, where it's necessary to at least allude to what the Supreme Court said or some things like that. But instead of just being about the criminal justice system, certainly there is a part of what we're trying to do here that does regulate the conduct of belligerents. And that's why we talk about things like the Geneva Convention or military commission. The whole purpose of a military commission, and looking at that from that perspective, is to say we want to treat people who have not followed the rules of war and put them in a system that says for not following the rules of war, you shall be punished. Now, there are other things, prisoners of war, for example, when we take prisoners of war and intern them, that is not intended to be punishment. That is intended to be neutral. So there are part of those folks that have followed the rules, have been captured, and we then treat them as neutrals, and we're supposed to take care of them. I don't think, and we've seen that necessarily violations of the law of war are not crimes. So we certainly have seen people who have been treated in our justice system. Massali, the person from Minnesota who was tried in Virginia, under our criminal system, that's fine. Could have also been certainly sent, perhaps not after the Fourth Circuit and some things like that, but in our minds at the time, could have been sent to Cuba, to Guantanamo Bay, and held and put before a military commission. But we didn't do that. Walker, who was tried, the first one who was tried, who was picked up in a prison in Afghanistan and brought back, who I thought was a perfect candidate to stand before a military commission, was tried, in fact, in federal court. Now, I understand he's a citizen. I understand the rules said that we weren't going to try citizens, but that certainly could have happened, and it could have gone either way. The reason there are military commissions is, of course, that famous 13 November memo in 2001 by President Bush, when he declared that this is what was going to happen, talked somewhat about the Geneva Conventions, talked about that we would have special military commissions to try soldiers. And at the time, a lot of us debated whether that was creating, if you will, jurisdiction. Was it something that he just decided he could do? And I think most of us said, no, I don't think so. I think what he's doing, and he's recognizing, if you will, being as a referee of two existing systems that would already work. I think the majority of my peers felt that because of some provisions in the Uniform Code of Military Justice and because of international law and because of customary law, military commissions could be held, not just by the president, by the way, but by theater commanders for various violations that would happen in theater. That has not happened. But certainly there was jurisdiction, or the system was started, and then somewhat contrary to popular belief, there were great debates. Well, they weren't great debates. There were long debates, hard debates in the Pentagon and other places about how we should do this, how we should accomplish military commissions. Should we just court-martial them, use the military justice system to treat these people? And for some reasons I'll talk about later, I don't think that's right. Practical either. But again, why the Geneva Conventions? Why all the talk about the Geneva Conventions? What are these things, the Geneva Conventions, the four conventions? They're really set up to protect victims of a war. And we talk about people who are injured or injured on land, combatants, hurt or shipwrecked at sea. We certainly have enemy combatants who are picked up. And then the Fourth Convention talks about civilians. So these are people who are no longer really actively engaged in fighting, but are picked up and now deserve some sort of protection. And that's what it's all. The law of war really goes to the Hague Conventions and some other sorts of things on how we do the combat part of it. But once we pick up those who are prisoners or otherwise disabled, we talked about victims of the war. Again, as I've said, we did much debate as to whether or not the Geneva Convention should apply. You know, and in that regard, I think some of us felt the way to do that was whether they applied as a matter of law or not. Simply say, apply the Geneva Convention. Now that makes it sound like I said, gee, that would be easy, then it would be a lot different. It wouldn't necessarily be any different. Because just because you apply the Geneva Conventions doesn't mean that everybody who is a prisoner is entitled to the protections of the Geneva Convention. You can lose your protected status by doing things a certain way, or conversely, you don't get a protected status if you do things a certain way. For example, if you come to the United States, if you're a member of an armed force, thus typically covered by the Geneva Conventions, but you come to the United States discard your uniform, put on civilian clothes, get in an airplane, and crash it into the World Trade Center, you will find no protections from the Geneva Convention in terms of the Third Geneva Convention and the process by which you're a prisoner. You're not entitled to those protections because you have abandoned your status. So I think much of it has to do with a framework of how we have done that piece. But my personal preference was to start with a viewpoint that we were, as a matter of policy, if nothing else, would apply Geneva Conventions across the board. Now that's probably a naive position of a simple soldier, because when I looked at it, I don't look so much on what do the lawyers know, right? Who cares? It's not about the lawyers. It's about the soldiers. It's about how do you regulate the conduct, how do you teach soldiers, how do you train soldiers, to what standard, so that they know, always know when they're going to, how they're supposed to conduct themselves. And I know this doesn't surprise you. The Army is an army of regulation. If you can do it, there's a regulation about it. Now, there's some good reason for that, because we really are an executive department, an executive agency of enumerated powers and delegations and all that sort of thing. So it ought to be covered in the main by regulation. We don't always follow them, but there's lots of regulations. And certainly there are regulations about how our soldiers treat prisoners, how we do interrogations. And generally speaking, the Army is the executive agent for the DOD in creating those rules and regulations. So it made sense for me to do it that way. We didn't do it that way. The decision was made that in terms of Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, so we're talking about Afghanistan here, that the Geneva Conventions would not apply. Now, of course, that 13th November memorandum said we would treat them humanely, and we would follow the Geneva Conventions as much as practical, consistent with military necessity and all that sort of thing. So there was a framework, but what I and some of my peers were more concerned about when we looked at soldiers is, especially later, we would have one set of rules that apply to Guantanamo, Cuba. And we'll talk a little bit about those interrogation techniques. Another kind of standard that would apply in Afghanistan. And then finally, a third set of standards that would apply in Iraq. Iraq has always, always been considered to be governed by the Geneva Convention. Not just Common Article 3, but all of the conventions. In fact, it still is today. So make no doubt about it that the Geneva Conventions always apply to Iraq. And so what happened at Abu Ghraib was always a violation of what that was supposed to be, the mistreatment of prisoners. Always was considered to be a violation of what happened. Okay. Then if we got into it, and part of this will be, I mean, I should also probably make it clear, my intent is not to be another general that comes out, retired general that comes out and tries to say what's wrong with this administration, what was wrong with Rumsfeld, why didn't he know what he was doing. This is hard stuff, and I think I'll demonstrate that in a bit. But the idea is there will be some differences. And the biggest difference I've had in the whole thing of the war together is the so-called torture memorandum, the Yu memorandum, where John Yu, part of the Office of Legal Counsel and Department of Justice, wrote this very technical memorandum on why, what was torture, what wasn't torture, and whether or not the President of the United States had to follow treaties, whether he had to follow customary international law, whether he was bound by treaties, whether he could be prosecuted domestically. And yet, if you look at almost anything, whether it be any of the interrogations, any of them, if you look at least those that go to the Department of Defense, if you look at the President's memorandum, if you look at the practices, nobody was anticipating, I think, torture. It becomes, however, one of those things, why do you write about torture and try to define torture if you have no intent of using those techniques that are almost torture? And I think we lost a big part of America. I think we lost a big part of some of the other worlds when they said, this is what they're doing, this is what's happening. And I think it was just one of those too bad. If I'm correct and all we were going to do was follow our regulations, that's what we were going to tell our soldiers, then what's the sense of this memorandum? It also loses sight, I think, of who are we talking to? For whom was that memorandum written? It's addressed to Jim Haynes, the DOD General Counsel. But is that a memo that we thought we'd put a cover letter on and send to Sergeant Jones in Cuba? I don't think so. So it was a framework that became somewhat lost. Again, that was then used, and originally there was a request from our Southern Command and from, as the Marines have called it forever, Gitmo, Guantanamo Bay, saying we need to change some of our interrogation rules. Here's our proposal. We then first had Secretary Rumsfeld send out a approved list of interrogation. Some heated debate among the service judge advocates, judge advocate generals, and the general counsel, the general counsels of the services, and the general counsel of the general counsel. And eventually a working group is formed, and that working group made up of judge advocates, civilian lawyers, General Counsel's later did a report to Haynes, who took it to Rumsfeld, who approved less than what the working group, by the way, approved, but some lesser interrogations, I think. Interestingly enough, Mr. Haynes, the Deputy General Counsel, has been much faulted for not listening to us service judge advocates. And I would tell you, as an aside, he has been more considerate of judge advocate opinions than any DOD General Counsel with whom I've been associated in probably of my 32 years. I spent almost 21 in Virginia and certainly 15 or 16 in Washington. And he's been much more considerate of opinions than others, but there are some things going on. In any event, again, we had a set of rules that were devised that were classified. And I think by being classified, the torture memo has been leaked. Some of the techniques that we're seeing on TV, we're assuming that's where they come from. In fact, the press has really said that's what went wrong in Iraq. That's what went wrong with Abu Ghraib, and that's where those techniques came from. It's almost all on the web now, at one side or another. And I would invite you to take a look at what the pictures show, the horrible pictures show, of beating people, of nakedness, of dog leashes, and all those sorts of things, and then read the rules, whether they be the working group's rules, Secretary Rumsfeld's rules that were intended only for Cuba, the Iraqi rules promulgated by General Sanchez's staff, and see if you can find anything in any of those interrogation techniques and rules that would justify what happened. And I've certainly read them many times. I've looked at all 12 of the investigations at some length. And there's it's simply not there. It's simply not there. What happened at Abu Ghraib? What happened? How could that have happened? I mean, my first reaction is our soldiers wouldn't do that. They just wouldn't do that. And I've heard a lot that it's training. It was a training. They needed more training. Look at the pictures. A reasonably bright third grader would say, this is wrong. This is ethically, legally, morally wrong. So I don't think it's a training. If I look at who did it, many of them were what? Confined facility guards in their private life. They were reservists. And they worked in Maryland, or they worked in West Virginia and some of the places in prison. So they should have known that. Certainly, we punished the main actors. They were court-martialed, as they should have been court-martialed. Former General Karpinski was reduced to grade administratively. She retired as a colonel. Colonel Tom Pappas, who was really in charge of security for Abu Ghraib, not operations, but be that as it may, received non-judicial punishment, Article 15, fine. Probably will retire a grade lower than what he was. Probably will be administratively reduced. And was relieved of command. Lieutenant Colonel Jordan, who was really in charge of the operations piece of it, is still in the process of being court-martialed. So certainly some things that didn't happen. Rick Sanchez, General Sanchez, had been nominated for a four-star. They withdrew his nomination. He's in San Antonio, retired as a three-star. Colonel Mark Warren, a wonderful American, a great lawyer, is not going to get confirmed, I don't think, to be a brigadier general. So all kinds of things happened as a result of that. And how could Abu Ghraib have happened? In my view, it's what happens in all those cases. There's not enough supervision. I don't think these people went into prison one day and said, let's go get 15 folks and abuse them. Were they trying to get intelligence from them? Well, they weren't intelligence subjects. They were mugs, thugs, and outlaws who were in the general population in the prison, and our soldiers brought them in because they were troublemakers. They thought they had committed some other crimes, but they didn't want to go out into the general population and supervise them, so they brought them into the security ward. And then I think over time started slowly to abuse them, and that abuse escalated when they were caught. It's what you sort of suspect. And of course, the real leader, General Karpinski, is in Kuwait. She's not in theater. And so there was inadequate supervision. And who should have been doing the supervising? Some of the people who were doing some of the bad things. Grainer. Foresight for some of the bad guys, but they were non-commissioned officers who we'd expect to do that. Oh, enough of that. Again, in our war context, those of us who are lawyers or criminal lawyers always think, how soon can we get to trial? When are we going to prosecute the bad guys? When are we going to try to gather evidence to prosecute them? But if you, again, think of the war on terror, that's not always what we want, or the only thing we want from prisoners, from detainees. We want information. And so somebody, not a lawyer, somebody has to decide what are our priorities for prisoners. And certainly in this war, the priority was intelligence. And sometimes when you make decisions on trying to gather intelligence, you bar other procedures. Certainly if you think about Miranda rights, or in my military context, we talk about Article 31 rights, Article 31 of the Uniform Code of Military Justice, which is much broader than Miranda. And it's not just custodial. It says any person subject to the code is bound to provide rights and all that kind of stuff to somebody else that's subject to the code. But once you make a decision that you're going to try to get intelligence, then you go down a different road. And you've got all the techniques. We've spent a lot of time taking a look at that. But Secretary Rumsfeld clearly made his priority intelligence. And so the first several pieces of that we went through. Then we had to decide, once we are going to try these people, how are we going to do it? Many of us, I hazard to say most of us in uniform, said we should not court-martial them. Because we would know that you can't apply identical rules. There's much debate about why can't we just use a court-martial. If you talk about a court-martial, you're really talking about a federal criminal procedure. The rules of evidence in court-martial is about the same as the federal criminal rules. The rules of procedure are very similar. The charges, except for some of the charges for sexual misconduct, are very similar. And so we felt if you're not going to give them their rights early on, then you're not going to court-martial. Same, I believe, for court. Why wouldn't you give the same rights? Do you expect a soldier that goes into a cave in Afghanistan or Iraq and finds somebody who is making explosive devices and has a computer open and has some other literature in a language you don't understand, have that soldier to arrest the individual, to read them their rights, to put them before a magistrate within 72 hours, to come back with all the evidence that they've taken, who would like to come back, and be available for depositions, to be available for cross-examining? Does that make sense? It doesn't make sense to me. So there needs to be some sort of way of having a trial that's fair, but doesn't necessarily have all those things about hearsay and confrontation that our current system has. But again, there was a great debate. How should we do that? What standards ought to apply? What standard of review ought to apply? Who is going to review them? And that, I think, unfortunately, has continued to this day. It's getting very refined. And we'll talk just a bit about that at the end. Okay. But we did come up with a set of rules that service judge advocates had much of an opportunity to write and to play in and try to figure. And ultimately, we ended up with rules that said you're innocent until proven guilty. There's a presumption of innocence. The standard is beyond a reasonable doubt. Some of the reviews, some of the panels, the juries, have similar rules of what they would have for soldiers. So in a court-martial, it's not always a unanimous verdict. It isn't always a panel of 12 people. Oftentimes it's three-fourths. Sometimes it's two-thirds, depending upon the level of crime and some things like that. It's always unanimous in death cases. It's always unanimous for death decisions in the military, and then it is a 12-person panel. But other times, it's not necessarily that way. Okay. A little bit, if I may, about the Supreme Court, and the war on terror. Again, I started out by talking a little bit about General Washington's lawyer and a military commission, and then military commissions in the Mexican War, and certainly we had them in World War II, where we had the eight saboteurs coming to the country, one of them being a U.S. citizen, by the way, who was tried by a military commission, and they were executed. And Ex Parte Querin is the Supreme Court case, much talked about, where the Supreme Court said, that's okay, that procedure's okay. That was the decision that we in DOD looked to when we came up with the rules. Of course, now there's been much talk whether we should have looked at Milligan and all that stuff. I won't get into that, but from my case, Milligan was about an American citizen in Civil War time who was home doing some things, and they tried to do a military commission over struck down as, I think, it should have been. Kind of different cases. The first case, this is the part where I think, if you really think this is easy stuff, there's two major Supreme Court cases on detainee operations and military commissions, too. In neither case is there a majority opinion. Both cases have plurality decisions. By that I mean there are enough justices on a certain issue to vote that way, either concurring or to vote on that issue that way, but join different justices for different issues, and so you don't have a straight line case. That's very unusual, and certainly to have two cases, I think it shows of how difficult some of the concepts are and what they do. Again, I read much about what it says that the military can't do in military commissions or what we can't do with detainees. But certainly, O'Connor, who wrote the plurality opinion in Hamby, does say pretty clearly, you can hold detainees, prisoners of war, till the end of hostilities. If it's a war on terror, you can hold prisoners of war, whether you tried them or not. So if we tried to prosecute Hamby by a military commission and he was acquitted, that doesn't mean he goes home. That means he just becomes a general prisoner of war. Now, I would submit to you trying to figure out the end of hostilities is a very different issue. And I think that is hard. Now, if you say, well, surely the war's over in Afghanistan, and I think you would say that, but what's happening? The Taliban, Al-Qaeda are still fighting. So I think, if nothing else, they make a case for the administration saying the war's not over. I think O'Connor does say you can't hold a prisoner indefinitely for interrogation. So I think she's also was kind of trying to figure out, what does all this mean? What does it mean, and how are we going to go that way? So pretty clearly, we can have prisoners of war. Pretty clearly, the authorization use of military force, in her mind, did justify some of the things that's going on. Now, she talks in terms of a war, saying what is traditionally done during wartime. And so if we look at gathering intelligence, if we look at military commissions, if we look at prisoners of war, then I think those are all pretty standard things that happen in conflict. Okay. Then the second case is a case called Hamden, which is also a fascinating case that's kind of cobbled together in certain ways. Plurality decision, the main decision written by Justice Stevens. But there we talk about whether or not the president could do these military commissions, whether the president on his own could do military commissions. And ultimately, the court decides no. Again, most of us felt that between, I guess I might as well say it, Article 21 and Article 36 of the ECMJ, there was ample authority with customary law and what we'd always done to do that. Some of us didn't think that, but most folks did, that we didn't need anymore. Justice Stevens says, yes, you do. You can't do that. And he also says, common Article 3 always applies to everybody. Now, common Article 3 is a lesser thing. It says there's a common Article 3 that's common to all of the conventions. And we have thought, some of us thought, that it was really intended for wars in which it was a state actor and there was an insurgency within that state. So the rebels would be covered by something. It's a very minimal standard. It now applies, certainly, to our war on terror. Except, of course, we know in Iraq, they get the full protections of the Geneva Convention, not just common Article 3. But it kind of said, it kind of went through that process. Even having said that, there's much about Hamden that the court outline was then taken care of with the Military Commissions Act. Again, I would invite you to take a look. It's online. The Military Commissions Act itself, look at its protections. If you would outline what Justice Stevens said in Hamden, and you then take the Military Justice Act and kind of check through it, that and a few other things that weren't mentioned in that case are all covered now by law. Not really amendments to the Constitution. Hamden wasn't, for those of you who care, a constitutional case. It was a case about what applies to the Uniform Code of Military Justice? How we treat justice in a crime, much more to do with that. Okay. A lot of talk about lawful and unlawful combatants, and why is that important? It's important because within the Geneva Conventions, if you have a lawful soldier, what would otherwise be murder is a soldier's job. On the battlefield, the idea is you kill the enemy. That's what you do. And that is not a crime. We give people medals for that, right? We treat them as heroes. That is not a crime. But if you kill soldiers while you're hiding within a civilian populace dressed like a civilian, you use civilian shields, you lose your protected status, and you become an unlawful combatant. When you target civilians, when you take airplanes, when you crash them into the World Trade Center to kill other innocents, you're unlawful. Lawful combatants, if they commit a crime, usually once captured, are tried the same way our soldiers are tried by court-martial. Unlawful combatants aren't. That's the big distinction. Now, whether you call them illegal, however you get there, the distinction is what did they do and what are they subject to? In one case, military commissions, in the other case, a court-martial. Or something else. Again, the Al-Marik decision, the one out of Richmond, the Fourth Circuit recently said, and I think probably that's what we're going to end up, said, if you are in the United States originally lawfully, whether you're a citizen or not, and we pick you up, you're going to go to the Justice Department, you're going to be tried in court. That's kind of what Justice Scalia says should happen with everybody that's picked up. They should go to federal court. If I'm right in saying the reason we want to have a different process is because we don't want soldiers to come back, we don't want them to have to protect evidence, we want them to fight, we don't want them to have to come back and testify. In the cases that are here, you could cobble a pretty good rule, a right-line rule, that said if we catch them here, we try them here. All those other reasons don't actually apply. Well, then why would the administration fight that? I think there are many in the administration and other places who feel these aren't good people, and they aren't entitled to a lot of them. We certainly don't think that we're going to let their conduct govern our conduct, or there'd be no rules. We would get their soldiers and behead them, right? That's what's happening. So certainly we're not doing that. The latest thing that happened is we had a case in Guantanamo where a military judge, and again, I guess I was a little offended, maybe just me, but I saw judge in quotation marks in an editorial. Peter Brombeck, who is the judge, has been a military judge with proper training for 20 years. He's tried more cases than almost any federal judge sitting. He's done murder cases, he's done felony cases, and he is an independent judge, to say the least. And I think if when he threw this case out saying, I don't have jurisdiction because the review team did not find them to be an unlawful combatant, and therefore I have no jurisdiction, it's jurisdictional. That will get fixed, I'm sure. Did Brombeck, in my judgment, have to do that? Not as I read the Military Commissions Act. There's an or. It says who is covered by the act, and then or, and then it talks about unlawful combatants found by a review team to be that. So I think that will go on. But it points out, I think, what is important, and that is that there is an impartial judge who sits to try to make his or her decision on the law and the facts and whether something can go forward. I think that's something that does go to a fair trial. And again, remember I said we're talking about military things. There are rules for military commissions, rules of court, if you will. They're like 300 pages. And it talks about how do you keep the judge independent and what do you do if somebody tries to interfere with the judge. It talks about rules for prosecutors. It talks about ethics rules. So it talks about the rules of court, and then it talks about rules that would enforce that. I think that's a pretty key piece as well. Okay. What don't we read about? What aren't we reading about? There's still a war in Iraq, right? Where are we holding their prisoners? Where are the military commissions for those folks? What do we do with that? Have you read anything about that? I haven't. We did something I never thought either the commanders of the forces would sign up for or certainly the administration would sign up for. We created a Central Criminal Court of Iraq, where people who violate the law of war, who attack our soldiers, are tried by Iraqi judges and sentenced by Iraqi judges. In fact, it's very interesting. 2 days ago, I think it is now, the New York Times had an article on how the military has gone way too far to be good to detainees, that we're turning too many people free. And this is the way the process actually worked at the lowest levels in Afghanistan as well as in Iraq. And this is our procedure. You pick up a soldier or an insurgent, and he's detained. Within a matter of hours, a lawyer, a judge advocate, will interview statements by two soldiers who say what happened, and have a sworn statement with pictures if available, and the judge advocate will make a decision, detain, don't detain. It then goes to a brigade level, where a three-person team, at least with a judge advocate on it, goes through that same process. Detain, don't detain. So about 50% of the people that are picked up, so says the article, are released within 18 hours. Then they go to a facility in Iraq where they're reviewed again, and some more people are released. Then they go before an Iraqi judge, and some more people are released. And then if there's a crime, they're tried by the military judge, and about 50% of those are convicted. But that's what we're doing in Iraq, is we're actually doing that. I never expected that you would get a commander, a general, to say, we'll let the other side try soldiers or insurgents, security detainees, to use the appropriate term in Iraq since it's the Fourth Geneva Convention now, to allow a home team to try soldiers or insurgents who have killed our combatants. Pretty amazing. Pretty amazing. What do we do with our soldiers? Well, what we do with our soldiers is we have always court-martialed our soldiers. We have not held military commissions for our soldiers. Why? I think it's a system that we have. It's a system we're comfortable with. We don't charge them with violation of law of war. We charge them with what they did. We'll charge them with murder, rape, mistreatment of prisoners, whatever it is. That's what we'll charge and that's what we'll try. And certainly we have tried many. That doesn't mean we don't have to report violations and report up violations by regulation. Of course, we do that. We call them flash reports when we do that. What about other people? Well, we certainly have tried a retired military person who was a contractor in North Carolina who was convicted of beating a prisoner with a flashlight and killed him, who's tried and convicted. We've done some other people. We've got some special jurisdictions that we'll bore you with on how we can do that, but we do that as well. Okay. That's, I'm sure, enough. If we're going to have some questions, and I just put that out as a framework, I would be happy to try to answer any question I can answer. I won't be able to answer some questions because, although it was a thing to me, I ended up being the number two judge advocate in the Army. So it doesn't mean I had a lot of meetings with Mr. Tennant or Mr. Gonzalez or Vice President Cheney. So those issues, all I would know about is what I read in the paper. And of course, my view is if I'm involved with it and it's in the paper, it's already 70% biased against me. Now, that assumes I know all the facts, but that's the issue. Yes, sir.
Let me just try and clarify something. Aren't we really fighting a war against certain specific groups that use terrorism as a tactic? We designate what groups. It's not every group in the world that uses terrorism as a tactic, a certain specific one. But I don't understand the comment.
Okay, if it was a question, the question is, aren't we really fighting certain groups, not every group, but only specified groups that we're looking at, and therefore I don't understand the call to war on terror. Okay, I guess from my viewpoint, we started by saying a certain group or groups of those individuals attacked us. In fact, one could make a cogent argument that they attacked us several times, that it wasn't just once. And therefore, we decided that we would target those groups, and then those groups kind of grew as there was other sort of resistance. If you don't see that as a war on terror, if you just want to see it as a war on those specific groups, okay. Yes, sir.
Have we declared war officially against anybody since World War II?
To the best of my knowledge, the question is, have we declared war against anybody since World War II? To the best of my knowledge, no. But the but always is there are other things that you can do, that Congress can do in lieu of declaring war, And what they have done is had an authorization for use of military force. And there's two of them for this conflict. One for the conduct in Afghanistan and one for Iraq, but not a declared war. That is correct.
If you're at war against the mafia or against drug cartel, is that a war?
I don't know. I think if we would have a situation where Congress would say, we're going to authorize use of military force against cartels, and here is when it's going to apply, perhaps. But I don't think so.
And does Geneva apply in such cases?
No. Geneva Conventions, at least now, I think Common Article 3 will apply anytime there's an armed conflict. So if there were a situation where Congress authorized that, then I would say, based on Stevenson's opinion, Common Article 3 would apply. Yes, sir.
Talk about the rules that apply to people in military service. What rules apply to people who work for CIA or private contractors or other non-military?
Yes, I think that's certainly a fair question. And the question was, what rules apply to those in the CIA, those who are contractors, those who are otherwise maybe non-governmental organizations that happen to be in theater doing stuff in conjunction with the conflict? That is sort of a lawyer question. And as I said, some of those people who have committed crimes that were contractors for sure, and that could apply to the CIA or anybody else who committed a crime, could be tried by various ways in federal court. Arguably, there used to be those who accompanied the force could have been subject to some sort of court martial or some sort of thing. We haven't done that for a long, long time, and I don't think we would be allowed to do that. We don't want to do that. Theoretically, some of those could, if we change the rules, we'd have to change the rules, could be tried by a military commission. We haven't done that. Be careful. The Military Commissions Act does not contemplate, it prohibits, it talks about aliens. So we're not going to be doing contractors who are U.S. citizens. Yes, sir.
With the lies and renditions, the foreign soil,
yes,
with allied countries, and then taking them to other countries for torture. How do we equate this to the world of public opinion?
The question goes to something called rendition, which rendition's actually been around a long time. I think rendition was started during the Clinton administration. Rendition, as it's supposed to be done, is typically kind of like extradition, where one country indicts or tries somebody, and that person isn't there, and they're found in a different country, and they're delivered back to that country. That's typically what rendition means. Extraordinary rendition, all I know about is what I read in the paper, or see on TV, has to do with us picking up somebody someplace and taking them, usually they say to Egypt or someplace, where they are tortured, and then later released. I would certainly be willing to go so far as to say, if somebody's being tortured, it is illegal. If somebody is being held hostage or family is being held hostage, it's wrong. It's illegal. But as to what the rules are for rendition, that's not per se a military thing. That's the Justice Department, CIA, different types of agencies who would have that capability. And I just don't know anything about it. Certainly when I've traveled internationally, when I've spoken internationally, people pretty universally, whether it's here or overseas, are very disturbed by extraordinary rendition. Yes, it certainly has hurt images. Yes?
So there's a lot of calls to close Gitmo. Just this week, call them how?
Yes.
What's your position on that? You feel it's just not working?
Okay. The comment or question was, even Colin Powell has said, General Powell, Secretary of State, former Secretary of State, has said he would close it today. I think his comment was, I'd close it this afternoon, if not tomorrow. He went on to say he would put the detainees in federal prison at Leavenworth or wherever the Army has a facility. I would go so far as to say this. Number one, if they're unconvicted people who are accused of something, I would not mix them with convicted felons. I would not do that. I don't think that's appropriate. Number two, if they're prisoners of war, they should not be mixed with convicts or convicted people. I have no problem with closing Gitmo or Guantanamo Bay and putting them in a different federal facility, but not in a prison. I'm not sure that's going to change a whole lot, personally. I mean, they still are what they are. I think it might go some places. Again, personally, I don't have any problems with habeas. I mean, all that view that these commissions were not going to be reviewed or the treatment wasn't going to be reviewed by federal courts, certainly has been true. There's been some 100 court cases that will go on, and there will be many more. And so I think there would go over time. Why don't we want to see more habeas cases? I think there's a belief that of the 380 or 385, if we had 385 more cases, it really just is the wrong precedent, doesn't go in place. But where it is, it doesn't matter to me. Yes, Mark.
The Fifth Amendment obviously doesn't apply to combatants overseas. On the other hand, we as a society do not approve of the use of force against detainees. There's an area between giving somebody their Miranda rights, which we would do even if they're here in the United States illegally and arrested for a crime, and a illegal combatant in Afghanistan or Iraq. Where do you see the line being as far as where we can go vis-a-vis interrogation and where that line should stop, that we don't go into what would be considered torture?
Okay. I guess we start with the Fifth Amendment, and there I think you're talking about self-incrimination, the right to be protected from self-incrimination, and interrogation techniques that are forceful, not torture, not causing severe mental or physical injury, but being aggressive. And I have to start by saying all the approved interrogation techniques have to do with not touching. You can't push people, you can't punch people, you can't slap people, you can't do that. So they're of the techniques, and they haven't changed that much over time, by the way, that are fairly aggressive. They just don't reach the level, I think, of causing concern to me. If they're not being beaten, if they're not being segregated for solitary confinement, if you will, for lengthy periods of time, and all that stuff, I don't see that as an issue. What is a tougher issue, I think, Buck, is how you view uncooperative detainees and what can you do for punishment? What do you do for a detainee that throws something through the bars every time you walk by, or spits on you every time you walk by? Should you be able to do something? And if so, what? I think those are issues we struggle with as well. Okay? Yes, ma'am.
A great deal about the need to create rules around how POWs, but I've been in wars many times before, and I think our past practices probably played into that. Can you elaborate a little bit more on why we needed to deliberate so much on new rules with these POWs?
Okay, fair enough. The comment or question was, we've been in lots of wars, we've had lots of prisoners, we should have a long history and procedures or rules and how we treat prisoners, how we interrogate and do that. I would agree with you, yes. I just think it's been so long in between conflicts that body of knowledge, that expertise, if you will, kind of went away and we kind of started over. I think that sensibilities and all that sort of thing have changed as much. And so I think there was a need to come up with something that we could articulate in that way. That's the best I can do. Okay? Okay? Thank you very much.
For more information about the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth, visit them on the web at www.dfwworld.org.